Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of 9/11 Freefall. I am the host, Andy Steele, and this is going to be a fascinating one for our diehard supporters to listen to. We have a retired fire captain here who's written some important articles, books, and such for various firefighting publications, who is questioning World Trade Center 7. And we need more of people with his credentials like him out there doing that. He's going to be giving his reasons for why he has joined the call for a new investigation into that building's destruction, joined the 9/11 truth movement, which is still going strong even here 24 years after the event took place. This is Raul Angelo. He's a retired captain with the Seattle Fire Department, having served 36 years of honorable service with it. He has served in leadership positions with several firefighting-related organizations, including the Fellowship of Christian Firefighters International, the National Fire Academy Alumni Association, Fire Department Instructors Conference, and is currently on the editorial advisory board for the Fire Apparatus and Emergency Equipment magazine. Captain Angelo has published over 350 articles in major trade magazines, including Fire Engineering, FireEngineering.com, Fire Apparatus and Emergency Equipment, Firehouse, International Firefighter, and the Encourager, and he has taught on firefighting related issues throughout North and Latin America. So that's North America and Latin America. Very impressive background, and we are happy to have him here on the show today. Let's bring him on in. Captain Angelo, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for inviting me, Andy.
So I became aware of you through a presentation you gave at the NFPA and then down through the grapevine. One of my helpers, Craig McKee, said, you got to have this guy here on the show. And again, your credentials and your background writing the book for the NFPA. Actually, I'm just going to flash that for our audience, and I'm going to have you talk more about this. But this is the book that our guest wrote here. It's Engine Company Fireground Operations, fourth edition for the NFPA. The logo is right there on the screen. Before we get into all of that and your background, talk more about your background. Just elaborate on your career, any important details that I left out, and how you got involved in the subject of firefighting to begin with.
Well, let me just add on to the book. So the book is published in conjunction with the NFPA, but it's actually a Jones and Bartlett Learning publication. They're the primary publishers. And I was asked to write the fourth edition. This is originally the Harold Richmond series. Harold did one and two, and then he died. They hired some other captain. I can't remember his name right now, who did the third edition. But that was almost 20 years ago. And then they asked me to write the fourth, which was really a major rewrite. It didn't even resemble the original book. And I think that's one reason why they dropped Chief Harold Richmond's name from that. So it wasn't that I said, hey, I think I'll write a book. They asked me to write it. And so I took that as a high compliment, but I wanted to do a really good job. And so I wanted it to be the most cutting edge, up-to-date information out there. I didn't want to regurgitate the same old things that was in the other books. Some things obviously are science and don't change, but I wanted to make sure it just wasn't another Engine Company book. And so I read every book out there that I could. And that book was about 5 years in the making, really. And right now it's still, I think, currently the most comprehensive Engine Company operations textbook on the market right now. They didn't have a high-rise chapter in there, and so I wrote a high-rise chapter and did a lot of study on that, even starting with Chief O'Hagan's book, High-Rise Firefighting and the such. But that's what kind of started this whole deal, was the high-rise chapter. That brought me to it. I can go on and tell the story, but that's basically it.
Why don't we go ahead and do that? Because you mentioned during your presentation, and these were your words, that your marching orders from the publisher were to include the studies from Underwriters Laboratories and the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Obviously, you're going to be talking about high-rise fires in this book. Would seem pretty smart and important to go to the quote-unquote experts. Of course, we here don't think that they're experts at AE 9/11 Truth because of our issues over the World Trade Center topic. But talk about that and your encounter with these reports and, you incorporated them or didn't.
Yeah, NIST stands for the National Institute of Standards and Technology, so NIST. And then UL was Underwriters Laboratory. And so they did a six-year study of experiments using modern fuels versus legacy fuels in modern construction. So basically, legacy fuels or traditional fuels are the furnishings in a home from the 1900s to about the 1950s or 60s, primarily wood, cotton, fabric, just natural fibers. But then with the introduction of synthetic fuels, i.e. plastics, that changed the whole fire dynamic because plastics are petroleum-based products. And so the fires burn faster and hotter. We saw flashover times happening quicker in the bell curve. And so they needed to do these studies to really try and figure out what's happening here with synthetic fuels. It's a great study, and I spent a lot of time reviewing and studying that. So when the publishers asked me, we would really like to incorporate that into the book, I went beyond just reporting the results of the UL NIST studies. I actually went ahead and implemented like I would. Here's how you do it. Here's how, here's why. And no book has ever done that. And I get criticism because not everybody wants to do things the way I would, but you need a book to tell you how to do it. What's the point? Okay. So I was really a fan of UL NIST. I'm trusting them. And then the high-rise chapter, I get approached by various people, but primarily there was an organization called Protecting All Protectors Alliance. And they came to me and they were asking me what was my opinion on World Trade Center 7 collapse and why didn't I include that in my high-rise chapter. I knew it had collapsed, but I didn't really go much beyond that because I knew firefighters that were there. I had friends in New York. And so they gave me their version and that was good enough for me. I just took it at face value. And so I didn't really have much to say other than I knew it collapsed. Then they asked me if I read the NIST report on Building 7 and I had not. And then they asked me if I was aware of the University of Alaska report. I was not. And then they asked me a really key question and this was really got me hooked. They said, are you aware that there has never been a type one high-rise building? Type one is the classification of high-rise structures from either the International Fire and Building Codes or NFPA, that there's been no high-rise building ever that has ever collapsed due to fire, except for World Trade Center 7. I never knew that. And I do talk about the first interstate fire in my book in Los Angeles. I forget what year it happened in, but to this date, the first interstate fire is still the classic primo high-rise case study because it was the entire operation. One Meridian Plaza, which was in Philadelphia, and three guys died in that fire. That one isn't the best case study because they had water problems right from the start. And so they never got a chance to actually, quote, fight the fire. If they would have been able to fight the fire with the designed water pressure, One Meridian Plaza would have had a different outcome. So they didn't really have the, quote, ammunition to fight the fire. But that building never collapsed. Whereas the first interstate, even though it was a sprinklered building, it was 100% sprinklered. They were almost done with it, and they didn't turn on the sprinkler system. So in essence, it was an unsprinklered building, but they had their standpipes that were able to deliver the water. So that was truly a high-rise firefighting battle. And that building didn't collapse. With four stories destroyed, they lost one civilian in that fire. It's in service today as the Aon building in downtown LA. So I knew those case studies, but I didn't really know about Building 7. And so I decided to actually read the NIST study. And I started seeing the problems with the study versus the videos and photos that accompanied it. And then I studied the University of Alaska report, which was done by their engineering department and forensic scientists. So these are side by side equally credentialed academics that use software to recreate the building. They're modeling. I don't know if they use the exact same programs, but they're pretty much the same. So whatever NIST did and was able to replicate, University of Alaska Fairbanks was able to do that as well. And they came up with diametrically opposed conclusions. So that was a tough one to resolve. And then finally, they sent me to this documentary, which is called Calling Out Bravo 7, mm-hmm. 2020 edition. And this was done by a firefighter by the name of Paul Cayley out of the UK. And when I watched that documentary, then I finally had to say, okay, none of these dots connect from the NIST report. There's so many flaws. There's so many inconsistencies. And when I put them all together, the only one that made sense to me was the University of Alaska report. And so with that one, I was able to go forward, not because I wanted to disprove NIST. My whole reason for this was I wanted to defend my work. I'd written a book that's being challenged academically and for accuracy. And, you know, when you write a book, you want to be right. You don't want to be wrong. You're not going to write stuff that's in error. You're going to write stuff that you believe is accurate. Mm-hmm. And I trust those logos. I trust the NFPA logo. I trust the NIST logo. I trust NFA, National Fire Academy, USFA. This is where we get our information from. These are reliable, credible sources of integrity that gives us our information. And so I had no reason to doubt NIST other than after watching all the videos and everything, what they were saying, what they were producing, and what I was watching in the video and looking on the photographs, it didn't match at all. And so I finally said, you know what, this is a flawed report. And I'll just be blunt. It was a dishonest report. And I don't believe it now. So I do believe the University of Alaska report. That makes sense. But here's the crux of it. This is the crux of the whole reason why we're even here today. When you look at the NIST report and all their modeling and their videos, it doesn't resemble the video of the collapse. When you look at the collapse of World Trade Center 7, there's lots of them. I know you can go to the Protecting All Protectors Alliance website, or you can just go to YouTube and type it in. This building comes straight down. You watch the edge of it, it comes straight down with no resistance. And NIST was saying, you know, the culprit was this column 79 on floor 12. Well, when you look at column 79, it's off to the right. It's not a center core column. It's kind of like to the far right of the building. So if that's the weak point, it's going to tip. And the University of Alaska reports, all their modeling has building 7 tipping to the weak side. And NIST, even though their modeling shows all kinds of contortions and bending, it doesn't show that on the video. It just comes straight down. I'm sure many of us have all seen the movie Casino with, I'm trying to blank on the actor right now, Robert De Niro. At the end of that movie, there's a whole montage of the old hotels collapsing in Las Vegas. And so you're watching controlled demolition after controlled demolition, controlled demolition. And when you look at World Trade Center 7, that's what it looks like. I'm sorry. You know, it doesn't match. University of Alaska comes out and their conclusion was, because all their models tipped, that the only way in their modeling programs that they could get their virtual building 7 to react like the video. So what we're watching on their program is what we're seeing on video, is for the interior and the exterior columns to be simultaneously removed on a horizontal plane, meaning you got to take all the support columns out right now, and then you'll get that type of free fall collapse. And so there you go. And that's where I have to stand, because you're following the science, you know, and we have to trust our gut. And here's another reason, Andy, why it's so important, is because just because NIST says it, even though they have a lot of credibility, doesn't necessarily mean it's true, or that these PhDs and professors and all these guys know better than I do. And even the chiefs are going to be in command, but it's the captain level that leads the guys into the building to fight the battle. a captain position company officer is the one that's going to evaluate up close and say, can we go in or can't we go in? Is this worth an offensive attack or do we got to go defensive? And those reports are going to be reported to the chief officer and he'll make the command decision. But it's really on the shoulders of the captain to be able to look and see what they're observing and make decisions. And so my decision on 7 is that I would go in and fight it. The fires were not that intense. I'm not saying it would have been easy, but it warranted an offensive attack, in my opinion, with the photos that showed the volume of fire. In the first interstate fire, the whole building surrounded by flames on a given floor. I mean, it's an inferno. It looks like a towering inferno. Those guys could not get above the fire floors. There were 4 floors and numerous stories above. I think it was 16, 15, 14, 13, 13, 14, 15, 16 that were on fire. They could not do any operations above the 16th floor because it was just too hot. So it looks hot. World Trade Center 7 building, it doesn't look that way. These are also office fuel loads. In my article, I published the occupancy list that was put out by FEMA. And I believe column 79 is on floor 12 of World Trade Center 7. But floors 14, 15, 16, and 17, right above that, they were all vacant. They weren't occupied. That's not to say there wasn't fuel load in there, but they're not fully functioning offices. Other than that, it's all banks, commercial, financial businesses, and government businesses. There's no exotic fuels in there. There's talk of the big diesel tank for the generator that caught fire, but NIST disproved that in their report. They said that was not a factor. So there you go. NIST is saying, it's not that. And they're putting the blame solely on office fuel fires. Well, look around in your office. What do you have? You got a desk, you got papers, you got a file cabinet, you know, you got your chair, you got your computer. I mean, that stuff only burns so long and it only burns so hot, but it's still a type 1 building and you're going to have fire protection on the steel members. But the temperatures have to be up and be sustained at temperatures above 1100 degrees to cause any weakening of the steel. And office fuel furniture and furnishings aren't going to burn that long to sustain that those kind of temperatures. So none of this stuff makes sense.
Well, it's because of a new phenomenon, right? I mean, that's what they announced, is that we have this thermal expansion of beams, Freeman to this girder, push the girder off its seat, hit the floor below it, create this chain reaction that's going to bring the interior down and then the exterior, because they got to explain why it looks like one unit coming down. All going to happen in 7 seconds. And what's interesting, too, because there's so much to work with what you just said, because you mentioned that film calling out Bravo 7. I just want to pull that to the forefront for our audience. If you haven't watched that, go on YouTube. They're trying to bury everything related to our issue on YouTube now. But if you search hard enough, you can find it. And they make an excellent case for why water was available to fight the fires.
Right.
World Trade Center 7. I don't have my notes on that in front of me.
No, but there's video. You could see the sprinklers operating in there. So there's definitely water inside the building. Now, they may not be operating as designed, but certainly maybe enough to control the fire. And they do have exterior shots of tower ladder and charge hose lines, tower ladder operating. The water supply was coming from the north towards the south end of Manhattan. And Building 7 is the furthest building north. So all the destruction happened south of Building 7. And certainly you can say, okay, the water lines are damaged, you know, in the vicinity of 1 and 2 and south. But if the supply is coming from the north, then 7 should be supplied.
Yep, you know? Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. They do a great job of laying this out. At some point, we got to get the gentleman who made this on the show to talk about it further. But check that out, folks. So they claim it's this new phenomenon happened for the very first time. And then their models, they don't even go through the whole entire collapse sequence as it starts to betray what we actually saw in real life. They just cut it off right there. And not to say anything.
They cut it off after 2 seconds.
Yeah.
After 2 seconds, they cut it off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, pretty much they cut the view off as soon as it starts not doing what they wanted to or what you expected to. And I want to make this point too, because I wrote an article a couple of years ago called "Silver Bullets," something or another that stops the NIST stories dead in their tracks. And we pointed this out. I want you to take a look at this picture here. We have the area of collapse initiation where the arrow is pointing, and the fires are burnt out. This is taken between 3:49 and 3:54 p.m. So if you have fires burnt out in the area of collapse initiation an hour before the building came down, you do not have heat to create right. what you need for thermal expansion of beams. No, the fires didn't come back an hour later. If there were no more combustibles available, they're not going to come back. I just want your comment on that picture, because to me that should completely throw the NIST report out the window. What do you think?
Well, no, it's a critical picture because, like you said, when the flames go down, just think of the fire triangle, the heat goes down. You're taking away the fire, and then the temperatures are going to start to drop. But here's the thing about steel, because if steel is forged in heat, right? If you've ever been to a foundry, they make their shapes by heating them. And then how do they get their shapes and how do they keep it strong? Answer, when steel cools, it retains its strength. So if you have high intensity fire, you could get warping, twisting, even partial collapse, sagging, all these things that NIST claimed could happen. That's true. But you have to have that sustained fire to keep that progress of failure moving forward. Once the fires are out and the temperatures are cooling, that twisted, bended steel is going to start regaining its strength, even though it's warped. It'll still be strong. The point is that when you look at the video, there's no structural resistance of any of the unaffected columns. I have never seen a collapse like that other than controlled demolition. I've seen partial collapses. Most of the collapses in high-rise buildings often happen during the construction phase. For a variety of reasons. But once the building's up and occupied and you have an event, like all the case studies, you could have localized collapse. Localized meaning maybe the floor, one or two floors, half the building in that area, the affected area, and we would expect that. But not the way Building 7 does, right? And if this event happened on any other date other than September 11th, if it happened in any other city, and it wasn't hit by a plane, and there were no firefighter lives lost in that building, this would be the number one case study of the century. We would be going, how did this happen? Everybody would be on it. Mm-hmm. Silence, nothing. Nobody wants to touch it. There might have been one or two things out there, but I don't think anything has come out as extensive as mine. And I think the reason is because if you cast doubts on 7, you implicate Tower 1 and 2, and it's very difficult for people to go there. Nobody wants to believe that it was something other than the plane and terrorists that were willing to kill these guys. If it's an inside job or there's some other factors that were human controlled, nobody wants to believe that these forces would willingly sacrifice 343 lives plus the number of police officers and all the citizens that died. They don't want to believe that. So they don't want to go there. And I get that. It's a very sensitive subject, which is why I don't really talk about Building 1 and 2. But 7, there should be no reason for that, especially now after, like you said, 23 years. We should be looking at this. If you really want to honor the 343, and it's everywhere. People have it on their helmets. I live here in Orange County. I see fire trucks with 343. Never forget. Remember, guys have it tattooed on their bodies, and there's patches and decals and three. Everyone knows what 343 is. If you really want to honor them, why wouldn't we want to try and find everything we could about what happened on that day? And we just don't. To this day, there's never really been a criminal investigation on any of the structures on that date, and we probably will never get them. But that's why I just try and isolate it to 7 and say, let's just look at the physics and the science behind it. And there's still resistance. But, you know, there's a fear because 7 implicates 1 and 2. So,
Well, you know, most times arguing with the debunkers, and I always found this, is when you get to Building 7, people would say, well, it's probably something we don't need to know about. Like, oh, the government just set that up in a day with a legitimate terrorist attack happening next door. Of course not. Obviously, it opens the door to a much bigger plot. And we have proven, and I say this confidently, having worked with AE for a number of years, absolutely, 7 was brought down in a controlled demolition that day. Somebody doesn't need a deep engineering background or firefighting background to look at that building and intuitively know that fire alone did not cause that. But, you know, in terms of the wider plot or whatever, we don't get into that here. Of course, we've got our own opinions. Right. I want to focus on this book here, and I'm going to show it one more time to our audience if I can get my mouse to work. The name of it is Engine Company Fire Ground Operations, 4th edition. And can you please explain to the audience what the significance of this book is? Because there were 3 editions before you came along. What does this book do for firefighters, people who study fires? Like, how do they use this in practical?
This is a book designed for the target audience is company officers. As much as I tried, I never made it to battalion chief. I did a lot of acting as a battalion chief, so I was in command of fires at the time, but I never made it to that official structure. So I had to stay in my lane, and my lane is being a senior captain. And so that's my target audience. And what this book does and why it needed to be updated was there are things like the thermal imaging camera, which is probably since the self-contained breathing apparatus, SCBA, that's been the greatest technology tool that has been invented since then. And that allows us to see in the dark and see through the smoke, right? It's a thermal imager. So that needed to be included into the book, those search techniques. Rapid intervention teams, which we have now. And again, when you talk about modern fuels in lightweight wood truss construction, which is still type 5, you're seeing a lot more flashovers happen more quickly in that time window of when the fire department shows up and gets into the building, all of a sudden flashover, right? Where it used to be maybe the fire, if left unchecked, would flash in maybe 20 minutes. Now, in left unchecked with plastics and the fuels, you can get flashovers in as early as 5 minutes into a fire. And so that really narrows our window to go into the interior and perform a successful rescue. We're still going to put the fire out, but it's really focusing on our ability to make successful interior rescues. And so that's addressed in this book, the rapid intervention team, because these events are happening and lightweight truss construction has very vulnerable building components when subjected to fire. We've had many case studies where firefighters have fallen through the floors because the floor trusses have collapsed, throwing these guys into the basement. Even in the Seattle Mary Pang fire, which was a type 3 construction, older building, the remodel of the basement was using 2x4 lumber and lightweight connectors. And so that roof fell, killing 4 of our Seattle guys because basically the affected area was lightweight construction. And so that had to be addressed, the rapid intervention team, the rapid intervention techniques. The water tanks on the modern fire engines are much more substantial. When I came into the fire department, we were still using Mack pumpers, as was New York, and the water tanks were only 250 gallons. Now it's pretty standard that you're going to have 500 gallons of water on the fire truck, on the pumper, and even up to 1,000 gallons. And so that allows us to attack substantially more fire without taking a hydrant supply. So that's why this book needed to be updated, and these type of technology advancements and equipment advances are incorporated into the respective chapters. But again, I'm going more out on a limb because I really wanted to not just give you the information and say, like, new trucks have 500 gallons per minute or 1,000, the capacity of 500 gallons or 1,000 gallons. So that means, and I'll give a scenario where a certain room fire, you could put that fire out in theory 4 or 5 times, right? Because you have that much water. Mm-hmm. So why take the time to take a hydrant supply? You're better off going forward, making entry, knocking down the fire. You got plenty of it, and then do your search. So I'm giving these scenarios in there to implement the strategy using the tactic. Strategy is the overall plan. The tactic is how you're going to do it. Another real important part was size up. In the third edition, size up was only half a page. I did a whole chapter on size up because that's where we're missing the boat. Firefighters aren't getting killed because they don't know how to raise a ladder or operate a hose line, open the nozzle, twist it. They know all that stuff. That's not what's happening. What's happening is they're not doing a proper evaluation of the situation, identifying the problem, and then coming up with the solutions. They just moth the flame. We put the fire out, put the wet stuff on the red stuff, and they go to town. Well, there's no plan, and there's no accountability. You have to have accountability systems. You have to be able to locate any firefighter at any given time in a fire. The technology nowadays is we're trying to get technology to solve this human problem where they're having these little trackers now in our SCBA units. And so you'll be able to follow it on a computer, like little dots where everybody is. I get it. And that's good. You can compare it to GPS, like the location on your phone. You can check locations on a phone. It's very similar to that. But that just gives you a general area. That doesn't necessarily give you the 3D or maybe a vertical view of where they're at. It just says, you know, you're on this X and Y axis. But I teach a manual way to be able to account for firefighters and how you can implement that when you make your fire ground assignments. And so there's a whole chapter on that. And I'm basically showing the average firefighter, whether it's a captain, a lieutenant, or a firefighter that's going to promote, how to run a fire with your first alarm assignments, your first 3 to 5 engines, and your 2 trucks. After reading this book, you can set up the fire ground for the chief to take over. You know where everybody's at by name, by company, by assignment, by time, when they went in, and you can keep track of anybody. If anybody gave a mayday, using some of the stuff that I wrote about in my book, you would be able to locate that firefighter, what floor he's on, what company he was assigned to, and what he was doing. If he was doing fire attack on the first floor and there was a mayday with a collapse, now we know he's in the basement. If he's on the second floor and there's a collapse, we know he's in the first floor. And so I show you in this book on how to do that. It was a challenge, but that's where this book needs to address the shortcomings that aren't in other books. So,
this is what I'm trying to establish for the audience is that this is basically a guidebook for firefighters for situations. And so the question of high-rise fires is a critical one because according to NIST, there is a danger here that if a fire breaks out, like the one you saw in World Trade Center 7, the whole darn thing can come crashing down on their heads.
Exactly.
And so there's an issue. So what I want to establish, first of all, is that this book in the firefighting community, you out there in the audience may have never heard of it before because you're not a firefighter, but this is something that a lot of people are reading, taking guidance from. They come up with different editions because it needs to be updated as technology and knowledge changes over time. And we're going to be incorporating a chapter here on high-rise fires. We want you to look at the NIST reports. But NIST is saying that, hey, you know, random office fires can bring down an entire building, which creates a new safety hazard for firefighters, which I don't ever hear them really address the implications of their report. I want to ask you and just sort of clarify the timeline. Were you questioning World Trade Center 7 while you were writing this? If that was the case, how did that impact your writing of the book? If it was after you wrote this, give us a perspective on having written this book and how that may have changed it if you were aware of the Building 7 evidence.
Yeah, no, I was not aware of everything I am aware of now about Building 7 when I first wrote the book. So it's not even in there. So all the World Trade Center 7 questions that were proposed to me came after the book was published. So, however, in the next edition, I definitely am going to address all these issues that I addressed in the article. But here's the deal. The Harold Richman series, which I referred to, he wrote 2 books. He wrote Engine Company Fireground Operations, and he also wrote Ladder Company Fireground Operations, which I'm also writing that book. I'm almost done with the ladder book. And all of this information is going to be addressed in that companion textbook, because the ladder company or the truck company, they're pretty much assigned to forcible entry and search and rescue and ventilation. They're not basically the engine company. Their job is to put water on the fire. You know, they handle the hose and the water, and the ladder company or the truck company, they do all the other stuff, you know, forcible entry, search and rescue, ladders, whatever else needs to be done to help that hose line get advanced to the fire. So they have a lot more responsibilities that go on simultaneously with the fire attack. So I am going to address that in the Ladder Company book, which should be ready to go to publishers at the end of next year, 2025. So I will address it there. And then I do have first crack at the fifth edition of Engine Company. Then I'll include it in that as well. But here's something I want to say, and I want to phrase this really carefully, because I'm not picking on my colleagues, but one of my friends and mentors, Deputy Chief Vincent Dunn, he's retired out of the FDNY. He retired in June of 2001. So he wasn't on duty on September 11th. He just missed it by about 6 months. But he had a book called Collapse of Burning Buildings, which I have. And since September 11th, he wrote a second edition to that. And he's got two chapters, one on why Tower 1 and 2 collapsed. And another chapter, the following chapter, is on Building 7 by itself. But what he does is he's totally relying on the information coming out of NIST. But he's throwing that out there, that these buildings could collapse. The defend in place means type 1 buildings are designed. And I went to many of Chief Dunn's seminars, and I remember this specifically. Type 1 buildings are designed to outlast the burn time of the fire load. In other words, even if you had a whole floor on fire, let's say floor 12, and there was so much fire that you couldn't make entry, the fire doors are designed, the ceiling and the floors are designed to encapsulate that floor, that all the fuel, if you did absolutely nothing, would burn itself out before there's any compromise in the structural integrity. In other words, it's like a big giant furnace. It's designed to withstand the burn time of the fuel loads. That's why many of the type 1 buildings in many cities were allowed to be built without sprinkler systems. It's because, not because the sprinklers wouldn't help, it's that the burn time was so low on fuels, maybe 20, 30 minutes, paper, files, furniture, that the structure would not be compromised. That's not to say there wouldn't be smoke. That's not to say there wouldn't be fatalities, but the building is not going to come down. And so Chief Dunn reverses his position in that book. He's written three other books. One of them is The Strategy of Firefighting, that he wrote since then. He wrote Battlefield Skyscraper and second edition of Collapse and Burning Buildings. So you have three textbooks out there that are saying that these buildings can collapse, but they don't tell you like exactly when, or what are the signs, or what do we need to look for, or at what point do we decide to abandon ship and get everybody out. They just said Building 7 is the wild card here, and so we need to prepare for that. But their whole perspective was based on the NIST report, and they cite that. The other book that's out there is High-Rise Buildings by Chief Jerry Tracy, Chief Murtaugh, and Jack Murphy. There are three authors on that. And they also give a page to World Trade Center 7 saying, here's this deal. We normally don't have collapses, but here's the example. Here's the wild card, and this thing can come all the way down, and we need to be aware of that. And again, their whole reason for stating that is based on the NIST report. So my contention is, why are we looking at that one wild card? Let's look at all the other case studies that are out there with significantly more fire. And everything was operated as designed. The structure withstood the fire because it was designed that way. And so I don't think we need to change all our documents. We don't need to change how we expect building or fire to behave in these type of buildings, the fire dynamics in type one construction. I think we're on the mark. You know, we're being thrown a curveball only because necesso. And it's interesting that even in NFPA 1700, which is the newest guide for structural firefighting, they don't mention anything about thermal expansion, fire-induced progressive collapse, not even in there. And their search and rescue section in 1700 is still to defend in place. And either NIST is right or the University of Alaska is right, but they both can't be right. And that puts a dilemma for us with all our instruction manuals, our textbooks, our NFPA standards, the building code. We either have to allow for the scenario of World Trade Center 7 or the NIST report on that is a flawed report. And that's what I'm saying. I'm calling for the NFPA and the fire service leaders to look at the two reports side by side because they're diametrically opposed. And let's come to a conclusion just with the science alone. We don't have to. I know there's people that don't want to go down the other avenues of, well, then what was it or who did it? Or you go down that conspiracy theory and immediately everybody starts, oh, conspiracy theory. You don't have to do that. Let's just look at the science and the physics. You know, it's been said that physics is unkind. You know, you're going to get what you're going to get. It has no agenda.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, and I just add on to that, and I always harp on this, is the picture I showed earlier of the fires burn out in the area of collapse initiation. No raging fires, no collapse initiating event from NIST. So if there's an error in the data that they used, then go back and correct it and deal with that. Right. You know, you the NFPA, obviously you've got some connections and you've made friends and peers throughout the years, I would assume. Have you talked to them about these issues? For instance, maybe people at the NFPA or other influential people in the firefighting world. And you don't have to mention any names if you don't want to, but if you have spoken to them, how have some of those conversations gone about this topic?
Yeah, I don't want to give names because it's been very cautious. And a couple of years ago, I was very nervous about even pursuing this avenue in writing. I mean, I would read about it, but to write something and take a stand, I was nervous because it's a very unpopular stand. Again, it goes back to if you implicate 7, you implicate Tower 1 and 2. And there's this sacredness. But you know what? I want to make this point right here that's really important, Andrew. You know who's open to all this information? The widows. They're open to hearing this. Family members of people that were lost. The people that throw up the most resistance and like you're crossing this sacred line are firefighters that didn't experience a loss on that day. They're just firefighters from around the country. And that 343 is so sacred. But we should be trying to accommodate the concerns of the families and the widows. They're totally open to looking at this. And if you attack me for going forward on this, in a sense, you're almost attacking some of the survivors who want the same answers, right? Mm-hmm. I find that very interesting. But let's get back to the question you asked, which ask it again, because I went off on a tangent.
Conversation.
Did I talk to anybody? Yes. Yeah. So I talked to 3 key people, very high ranking in the industry. And their first response was that I shouldn't associate myself with these people. They're a bunch of wackadoodles. I need to protect my reputation. And they didn't want to hear it. They're sticking with the traditional narrative. But I had already read the reports. And I don't think all of them did as thorough as I did. So even though I get what they're saying, because I was one of them, it took me 20 years to get here. It took me 20 years. because I had personal friends that were lost in that date. I had deputy chiefs that allowed me to go to the site when it was still active. I had friends in the FDNY. And so I had firsthand eyewitness perspective. I didn't need another perspective. That's why all these other people who were questioning it, I just blew them off. It didn't concern me. But once I wrote a book, right, and now I got skin in the game on knowledge and I'm imparting knowledge, I feel a sense of that, you know, I have to back my work. There's responsibility and credibility and maybe even to some extent a form of moral liability to make sure that you're putting out the right stuff. So even though these leaders were cautioning me, I had already read the reports. And so you're asking me to believe something that I'm an intelligent guy. I'm not a PhD. Well, I am a PhD, actually. People don't know this, but I have a PhD. It's a private high school diploma. But it was supposed to be a joke. Okay.
I know. It took me a little slow sometimes.
Maybe it's better if you say public high school diploma. But anyway, my point is it's critical thinking skills. You know, you're checking mm-hmm. your gut. You're using rationale. You're using what you know on physics and science and all your years of experience on the fire ground. And you're asking me to believe things in the NIST report that just don't make sense. And I'm sorry, I respect your positions, but I'm not going to check my brains out and believe like you do simply because you have a national title. So I backed off, and I don't think I would ever have this article published. I don't think they would publish it in the United States. The International Fire and Safety Journal is out of England. It was the international people that came to me and say, we'll publish the whole thing. If you write it, we'll publish it. They wanted it bad. And this thing was published in 3 months. So the international community really is more interested than the American fire service community. So, but now that it's out, I have heard from those same individuals, national leaders, and they have encouraged me. They support what I'm doing. I don't think they want to be in the point, but I think they all welcome a reexamination of what happened on World Trade Center 7 based on the physics and science, again, taking the politics out of it, specifically because it wasn't hit by a plane and there was no firefighter lives that were lost. So let's look at this as a case study in fire, in high-risk firefighting.
Well, let's focus on this for a moment, because I want to just properly frame this for the audience, because this just hit this week here, and you have an article for the International Fire and Safety Journal. Let's show it to the audience there. That is what it looks like. You can find that online, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, how the opportunity came up and some of the stuff that you cover in this article.
Well, the article, like I said, basically covers the journey we just spoke about. There was a first report from FEMA that was done a few months after September 11th. That was like the preliminary report. And it's interesting to note that in the FEMA report, there were two things that stuck out to me. One was the occupancy list. Who's in the building? There's no exotic fuels. You got government offices and you got financial institutions. So you're talking office fuel loads. And in the FEMA report, they specifically state that it's doubtful that these fuel loads could have created the temperatures necessary to compromise the steel or to damage the steel so that it would either weaken or collapse. So there's the first thing. FEMA report is the first people coming out saying this fuel load isn't going to generate those type of temperatures in the 1,000 degree plus range. They'll burn out, right? And again, the occupancy list. So that was the first thing that was like, So that's in the article. Then I went to the NIST, covered all their diagrams. There's many illustrations of how their computer modeling doesn't match the video. The key is the video. If we didn't have the video or the photos, I don't think you would have to flip a coin on who's right. But the video is, that's the key. And when you look at it, go straight down without any structural resistance anywhere of unaffected columns. It doesn't make sense. Now, here's what's interesting. There's another guy who I got introduced to and I spoke to. His name is David Chandler. David Chandler is a high school physics teacher. I think he has an MA in physics and an MA in mathematics. He's not a PhD, but a very smart man. And I've spoken with him numerous times. He was the one who challenged NIST in the professional review before they published it. And they have their own ways of doing things. But he was able to measure the time and the distance of the video collapse. And he's saying this is free fall. Mm-hmm. This is a free fall collapse. And NIST fought that. It wasn't until it was brought to their attention with the measurements that NIST yielded. And then in their report, they had to include that Building 7 collapsed by free fall. And I think they gave it for so many floors. But they had to reverse their position. That was a huge crack. Basically, NIST couldn't get out of it. That tells me right. that what they're putting forward isn't necessarily correct. It's just who's good enough to challenge them. But this guy was. And they caved on that. So you're
right. Well, they got embarrassed at their technical briefing being questioned about this. And you could see right. Cheyenne Sunder, the lead investigator, kind of stumbling and fumbling his way through his answer there. And so then they later they included the free fall, but they just try to bury its significance within their stages of collapse there and don't really focus on like why this is important. And it's like you got to fight for every point.
But they did include the free fall graph. Yes. I don't know if they meant to do that, but it's in there. And Chandler confirms it. And when you compare that to Chandler's graph, which Chandler's graph is in the UAF reports and the Alaska report, both graphs of free fall are in both reports. So that building did collapse free fall. So when I say collapse now in reference to Building 7 and I'm talking to people, I say global free fall collapse. I don't just say collapse because collapse could mean partial, pancake, mm-hmm. lean to. There's all kind of collapses. But when you say total global free fall collapse in its own footprint, now you're talking very specific. And I use that every time because that is how Building 7 collapsed. Free fall in its own footprint. How do you explain that?
Well, we have debates here about whether we should use the word collapse in our writings about it, because we don't obviously believe that it collapsed. Right. We believe it was made to collapse give any power to the other side, even accidentally. So we're coming up on our last seven or so minutes here.
Well, let me just say this in reference to that, because when people say you can use the same argument with demolition. They'll say, well, do you believe it was a demolition? And I mean, I do. I do. But when I explain it to people, what I'm saying is my official position in writing is going to be, I agree with the University of Alaska report that the only way that this could happen is with the simultaneous removal of interior and columns and exterior columns on a horizontal plane. That's a nice scientific way of saying you got to rip out an entire floor. And the only way you can do that is through a demolition.
Golly, how's fire do that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you know, the proper investigators would have to take those conclusions and go further and say, okay, well, what causes this? Oh, explosions or explosives, excuse me. Who would have set them that day? Okay, so in our last couple of minutes here, this is a question I commonly ask a lot of guests because it's an issue that we run into now. 24 years after the event happened, we're coming up on the 24th year here. People say, well, you know what? You've been talking about Building 7 for so long, Andy. I'm beginning to think you got a point there. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of crazy stuff that's happened in the world that's really opened my eyes. And I know I was laughing at you 10 years ago, but I think you're right. But, you know, that was over two decades ago. What are you going to do about that? Who cares? Who cares? Especially with the world marching on now, everything going on. Why, even if you were right about Building 7 and all of 9/11, why is this important today? Why do I need to care? You mentioned the 343, obviously. I think to the people that knew them, they might care. That's my thoughts. But I want to hear your thoughts. Why Why focus on building seven now?
I agree with you. I would, when I speak to these people, I say, well, what's the end game here? It's like trying to really pin down on who killed John F. Kennedy. At this stage of the game, what difference does it make? Who cares? Well, the reason is because now we know, and if they do release these records shortly, everyone knows now that Oswald didn't act alone, right? And that's the main thing. You could go with other shooters. You can go with CIA. You can go with mafia. The point is they fed us this line that Oswald acted alone, just like this shooter that just recently tried to assassinate Trump. He acted alone, and they got him. None of that stuff makes sense. And then they cremated his body, like right now. Where's the forensic? They bury the forensic evidence. So you started to see a pattern, you know, even with the COVID, the masks, the Russia hoax. You're starting to see more frequently that they just tell us what they want us to know. Whether you believe in the Ukraine war and Russia or Israel and Iran, I mean, we're only getting the information that they package. And so you're seeing now how the government really tries to feed you the information. And not everybody in the government are smart people. And so for me, it's like, trust your gut, trust your knowledge, trust your ability to learn, comprehend, reason, and study, because the information's out there. And so that's why, is because I don't believe anymore. I'm going to say it bluntly. I don't believe anymore what my government tells me. I used to think that was only North Korea or Russia, but just take the President Biden and how they hid his decline in cognitive recline. We all saw it. We all know what we're looking at. You're looking at a confused man who can't complete a sentence or a thought, and yet they're telling us, you know, don't pay attention to that. He's on his game. We know what we see. And that's why I ended this article with, it's now one of my favorite quotes. I never used to quote it, but I ended the article with, "The great Oz has spoken." Oh, by the way, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. And that's really it in a nutshell. And if we're fearful, they can control us. If we don't have fear, they can't control us. But the information's out there, especially with social media and there's all these platforms. They can't control us like they did in 1960 with information. It's an information war. And now I want to be a part of the battle. I don't want to be sitting on the sidelines. And so here I am, Andy.
Good for you. And just, you know, mentioning the Biden thing, you're talking about his decline. And they act like, you know, after we watch this guy stumble and fumble his way through the presidency for 3 years, then he goes and he has a debate with Trump and they're like, oh, my God, he's senile.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's like they act like they haven't seen him in 3 years. Like this is some new revelation. I think the whole thing was just sort of a setup to create this backstory and run him out of office. But
well, whatever the motive is, though, is you got these talking heads that are out there telling you and they want you to believe this. And we all know it's not true because we can see it. Well, on Building 7, I can see it. And what Dr. Sunder and the guys at NIST are telling me to believe, you know what? I'm sorry. I don't buy it. Nope.
Well, it's really good to study history because you learn from history that things have always sort of been like this. Like, you know, 100 years ago, thinking on psychology and all sorts of other sciences were very different, but they were all following the same scientific method, but they all had these biases that they were following too. And we do that in modern day as well. And so it just takes people being brave enough to speak out and point out the obvious to change the tide of things. Sir, thank you so much for throwing your hat in the ring on this very important issue, World Trade Center 7. It matters now just as much as it's ever mattered, maybe even more so as we sit here nervous about world events. And we got to keep on talking about this, waking people up, reminding them that they lied to you then. They're probably lying to you now. And get you all your knowledge together and bring it out to the world. But thank you for coming on Free Fall today.
Hey, thanks for inviting me, Andy.
Hit that notification bell and slam the like button and subscribe. Thanks.